All right, we'll call to order the April 3rd meeting of the Town of Cary Beach Historical Preservation Commission. The first item is adoption of the agenda.
Before that, we need to excuse Gary.
Oh, yes. Actually, he wasn't here last time either. Is he getting messages?
He's getting the emails.
He is getting the emails, okay.
But no correspondence from him?
I have not heard from him.
And I haven't, as chair, I haven't heard anything either from Gary.
So that's two in a row.
Two in a row.
What is our rule?
Three in a row.
Well,
they've excused them both times, so technically.
Today would be one.
They're unexcused.
Yeah, three unexcused.
Yeah.
I would propose that we don't excuse this time. That would just be my recommendation.
I'm sorry, I couldn't, I was talking, what did you ask? What did you say?
My recommendation is that we don't excuse him this time because there was no communication.
Right.
Okay.
So this would be number one.
Yes. So would you withdraw that motion to excuse?
Oh, I didn't make a motion. I just said we had to talk about it.
All right. Next item is the adoption of the agenda then. Is there a motion to adopt the agenda?
Make a motion to adopt the agenda.
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Next item is adoption of the minutes from our January 3rd, 2024 regular meeting.
Motion to adopt the minutes as presented.
Second.
Any further discussion?
Aye.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Public comment? None. Okay, so we'll pass on to old business, and there's nothing on old business. So under new business, we have the oath of office to our two members.
Okay.
Who's doing oath of office? There you go. Okay. We're going so fast, I didn't know if it was...
Tony, you're first.
Yeah, you should probably go down there so we can take pictures and throw confetti.
And the Constitution and laws of the state of North Carolina.
And the Constitution and laws of the state of North Carolina.
So that means no more January
6th. Not inconsistent therewith.
Not inconsistent therewith.
And that I will faithfully discharge my duties.
That I will faithfully discharge my duties.
As a member of the Historic Preservation Commission.
As a member of the Historic Preservation Commission.
For the town of Cary Beach, so help me God.
For the town of Cary Beach, so help me God.
As old as I am.
Thank you. You have to wear a suit next time.
Yeah.
It should be wetter than the trunk of the car you used to.
All right, two new members.
Very good, dude. Excellent. Okay, just very quickly, because I know our new members you know, may not be familiar with the history of the Historic Preservation Commission. And so a couple things I would recommend before I turn it over to Attorney Eldridge is that you may want to look at the Town of Curie Beach webpage and kind of learn about the Historic Preservation Commission, what it is, the boundaries of the district that we're responsible for, and these type of things. You know, essentially, in a just a two-sentence thing, is that within our business district, our historic district, we went through a process to establish a historic district because that is really the only way one can influence, if you will, the external, the exteriors of buildings within that particular district. And so there's a number of rules and regulations related to that, and this is the commission that does it. So if anybody wants to do anything on the external, we don't have any control on the internal, but on the external architecture, these sort of things, is that we do have a little bit of control, but we have to go through a process, and the process is very similar to a court process. I'm going to let Attorney Eldridge talk about that because he has some readings. We actually have gone through kind of a mock case at one time. It probably doesn't make sense to do that again. But I believe that Attorney Eldridge has put together some readings. So do you want to kind of maybe add a little bit more to that and talk about the readings?
I'm getting a lot of pressure from my boss, so I'm going to try to keep it short.
Okay.
Here, read this stuff.
Yeah, let's go through all of them. One by one.
For the benefit of the newcomers, but also for the benefit of the board, of the commission, particularly since council approved some text amendments by an entity known as Sombra at their last meeting, and sometime in the near future, they're going to be beginning, they want to construct a residence in the downtown preservation overlay district. So there'll be a situation where we'll have to entertain a COA. I don't know when, but I don't think it's going to be that far off. As the chairman was saying, why the Historical Preservation Commission? Because there's a statute out there that prohibits local governments from requiring aesthetic features on the exterior of buildings. I think it's residential only. So the town can't regulate the aesthetics of the outside of a residential structure. The only way that can be done is by setting up a Historic Preservation Commission, doing all the legwork that we spent almost 2 years, I think.
About 2 years, yeah.
Surveying the district, getting some input from the state, producing a report and adopting design standards, which is one thing that I've not included in your reading, which is something that you definitely need to become familiar with, which I'm sure is on the website. That's the only way, under all of our general statutes, that you can control what the outside of a building looks like. And that is important for Curie Beach, because Curie Beach's downtown center is so unique. I can't think of another town on the coast of North Carolina that only has one stoplight and the appearance of those buildings. And it's not, the COA doesn't say what businesses can come in. The COA simply says how that business will look. So McDonald's can open up downtown, but they're going to have to conform the outside of their building to the design standards that the town has adopted. That's sort of how it works. Why do we want to spend some time making sure that we do COA hearings or quasi-judicial hearings correctly? For two reasons. The one may seem intangible, but I think there's some substance to it, reputation. I think it's important for applicants, and particularly if they're represented by attorneys who do this type of work in other local jurisdictions, to see that we know what we're doing, that we're competent when we do it, that we're professional, and that we're qualified when we act that way. And I've seen plenty of instances where that has not been the case, and it's kind of painful to watch. The other reason we need to do it correctly is because if we screw up, it's every possibility that the matter will be taken to the local superior court for judicial review, and if we lose that judicial review, we'll be taxed with the other side's attorney's fees, which can easily approach six figures. that is a given, it's not discretionary. They changed the statute to say that if a private litigant challenges the government and is correct, and they have three different scenarios, and it's not reciprocal. If the city wins, they don't get to do it, but if the litigant, if the challenger wins, they do get attorney's fees. So that is one of the reasons we need to pay attention to doing it the correct way. The next point I would make is, what's the difference between a quasi-judicial hearing and a public hearing, which are now, public hearings are now called legislative hearings. In a legislative hearing, like when, if we change the zoning ordinance and we present that to council, council will conduct a public hearing where anybody can get up and make any comment that they want on the proposed text amendment. A quasi-judicial hearing is simply a trial. And what that trial consists of, or is the applicant and other witnesses, and they could be expert witnesses, being sworn under oath to offer testimony, to offer exhibits, to present evidence in support of their application based on what they need to show, which is enclosed in the code, or which is provided for in the code. If they meet that burden, they get whatever it is they're looking for. If they don't meet that burden of proof, they are denied. So again, going back to the criteria, if you do it correctly, you minimize that risk of them appealing that decision. And what are quasi-judicial decisions used for? Special use permits, which council handles, variances from zoning regulations, and appeals of administrative decisions like issuing a citation or interpreting a zoning provision in a certain way. Those two things, administrative appeals and variances, are handled by the Board of Adjustment. The final quasi-judicial matter is COA hearings, which this commission is in charge of. The COA hearings are basically conducted, the whole business about...
Could you describe what a COA is? They may not know the, what the COA is.
I often resort to acronyms. If you look, and I'm going to try to give you the right page numbers. When I printed these from the agenda, I didn't get the page numbers, but look at your agenda page 38 and see if that isn't the regulation for 1508120, downtown preservation regulation. This is one of the things that all of you need to be very familiar with. It lays out the intent and purpose. It's referred to as POD throughout these regulations, and if you look at the bottom of the first page, it talks about certificates of appropriateness. A certificate, a COA, shall be required for any erection, alteration, restoration, relocation, demolition, or destruction of any exterior portion of any structure, including above-ground utility structures or any type of outdoor advertising. One was an asphalt driveway, and one was a rather recent statute there, which Manning objected to very strongly. And both of those things, if you look at Chapter 15, there's a definition for structure. And structure definition says anything affixed to the ground. So both of those things, or at least the driveway, was a structure. So that's a good example. Somebody comes in, they want to put an asphalt seal on their driveway, and they're in the downtown preservation district. Everybody else's driveway is white concrete. Is the black asphalt seal harmonious with the look and feel of that neighborhood? That's basically what it comes down to. And so when you read those regulations, it tells you, it spells out all of the things that the HP Historical Preservation does. But if you turn to page, let me find it. And this will be, I don't know the agenda page number. If you look at if you look in the right hand corner, you'll see the numbers 1/5. Go to 4/5.
It's page 41. It's page 41 of 42.
Yeah, thank you. If you look at the middle of the page, there should be a number 5. When you hear a COA application, you're going to want to base your decision on number five, which is...
Telling us something?
Telling us something, Jim.
Read it. So you'll see that COA decisions that you all will make in open session are based on the zoning requirements, the material surface textures and patterns, the architectural details, the roof shapes, the proportion shapes and positions of windows. Again, think of the all-glass house being proposed to be located in the downtown business district. Is that congruent with the look and feel of that district? And in particular, although it's not spelled out in A through G, but it is spelled out in the first sentence on the design standards, which again are on the website that you need to become familiar with. Whatever you decide, those change, if an appeal is made of the HPC's quasi-judicial decision, that appeal goes to the Board of Adjustment that acts very much like a North Carolina appellate court. They will look at the record that HPC put together, including the transcript, the exhibits. One of the other things that will happen in the COA hearing is, again, by these provisions, the building inspector will make a report, come and testify to the commission as to his or her opinion as to whether or not the proposed alteration to an exterior feature is consistent with the criteria that needs to be met in order to get approval for that. But they can't do anything until they get that COA issued. If you look at page 36 of your agenda package, you'll see 1206050 quasi-judicial procedure. And that's basically what staff follows. There isn't a whole lot for you all to, you need to be familiar with it, but it doesn't spell out your responsibility. One of the tricky things about a quasi-judicial decision, you all will hear the evidence and the chairman will sum up the evidence. Based on that evidence, you have to make findings of fact, which are easily confused with conclusions. But basically, the decision is going to say, so-and-so is applying for XYZ, the applicant appeared and testified, any witnesses on their behalf testified. Based on all that evidence, HPC makes the following findings of fact. First one's usually the applicant has standing. Then you walk through, if they want to do, part of the design standards includes the painting scheme. So let's say somebody comes in, they want to paint their house green, and all the other houses in that preservation district neighborhood are painted white. Jump ahead to the conclusion. The conclusion may be that that green painting scheme does not match or does not comply with the design standards. I'm just making this up. That would be the conclusion. Rather than say, then the findings of fact would be simply the applicant wishes to paint his house green. The next finding of fact is all the surrounding residences, residential dwelling units in that immediate neighborhood are painted white. Then you've got your findings of fact that provide the basis for the conclusion that you'll reach later on in that document as to whether the painting scheme complies with the design standards. So that's the tricky part. Usually there'll be a worksheet that staff and I will develop and hand out to you all, which will make that process a little bit easier. The next item would be a blog from Coach Cannons from the School of Government, which are it's an invaluable resource. If you ever have any questions about what you're getting ready to do, you can go to that website and search, and chances are pretty good you'll find a blog article on it. Anyway, page 26 of the agenda includes a Coates Cannon blog on basics of historical preservation commission. So I invite you to read that. Likewise, I think it's either page 18 and 28, the next coach canon should be entitled Making Quasi-Judicial Decisions. I definitely encourage you to read that. Likewise, agenda package page 7, another coach canon, building the record for a quasi-judicial decision. You can review that, but I want you to note the date. This was published in 2015. All of the law about quasi-judicial decisions until quite recently was the result of various appellate decisions by the Court of Appeals and the State Supreme Court over a 30 to 40 year span. They might have one issue and they develop a ruling, they might present with another issue and they develop a ruling. So what happened just a few years ago was the General Assembly took all of the planning and zoning and development approval basics of city law, which is typically Chapter 160A, and they rewrote all that into Chapter 160D. So when you read about building the record, and also when you look at the next one, which is on page 12 of the agenda package, standing, which is one of the difficult things that any quasi-judicial body has to wrestle with. These things are actually, the reading is good and useful, but you need to know that both building the record, certain aspects about evidence, and standing are now addressed in the statute, a 160D statute, which is attached to your agenda packages, page 31, and I do want to spend a couple minutes looking at some points on that, because it may be helpful to you. One of the things, again, in a public hearing, anybody can say anything about the subject, but you might have a request that coming before you as a COA that ends up being what we call a red button issue, where the adjoining neighbors are just outraged at what's being proposed. Now, a lot of those adjoining neighbors are going to want to speak out at the hearing, but they have to have standing to really be able to do that. Again, it's like a trial. You all are the judge and the jury, as a matter of fact. And for some, and the applicant certainly is the party, but the question arises is Ms. Jones lives next to the applicant and is absolutely opposed to what the applicant is proposing. Does she have the constitutional right under the due process considerations to participate in that hearing? And by participating, I mean she gets to ask, not only will the applicant present his case, and not only do you all get to cross-examine or examine the applicant, but opponents to the applicant have the constitutional right to cross-examine. So it's not open to everybody. You have to meet certain criteria. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with sometimes in the midst of a hearing, because standing is a very sophisticated legal concept. But if you look at this particular statute and you look at subsection C, the General Assembly has given you some guidance on standing. Any person possessing basically an interest in real estate, that's subsection A. B, somebody holding an option to purchase property also has standing. C, the applicant. And where it gets tricky is number two, any special person who will suffer, any other person who will suffer special damages. It took me years to understand special damages. They're not damages that, in the sense that you get rear-ended, you get whiplash, you have pain and suffering and medical expenses. Those are damages. Those are compensatory damages. Special damages are, the best example is, I own a really nice house on a nice road, and somebody gets a permit to develop a 60-site campground next to me. And I get an appraiser who confirms that my property values are going to be reduced by $30,000 or $40,000 due to this campground next to me. That's special damages. It's a very tricky thing. And it's even trickier to try to cross-examine, for you all to examine the opponent that wants to speak, who's absolutely clueless. You know more than that, and you don't know much about standing, but you know more than that opponent ever will know about standing. So it becomes very tricky how to handle that. Now, I'll be there, but I prefer to be there in an advisory capacity rather than being your all's attorney, because that requires another attorney to come in at the same time, and I just don't want to be caught up in all that. So they'll, you know, for example, the opponent may be wishing to speak and you're not sure she has standing, I'll catch that that caution, and I'll suggest various questions that you can ask that might help you get to that, to decide, you know, whether she can participate or not. Some jurisdictions allow those people to speak, and they figure out that it'll get weeded out and addressed during the judicial review, but it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to let them. Again, you're the judge. You can tell from all the recent news that judges have a lot of authority on how their proceedings are conducted. So that's one thing to keep in mind. If you look at, on this same statute, if you go in these our page numbers on the bottom of the statute. If you look at page 2, you under subsection H, you'll see they provide a description of what the record consists of. And again, staff will help you through this. We'll actually have copies of what is available before the hearing, and we'll have the and they'll be labeled and numbered. And we'll have those labels and numbers available for any new documents that are presented. The and it's also important to understand how judicial review works, because it's the same idea for a BOA. If an HPC decision is appealed to BOA, it's called in the nature of certiorari. And that basically means, and we'll take judicial review as an example, it basically means that the court is not going to look at anything else but the record. When I have a judicial review of a quasi-judicial decision, there's three steps. It's not a trial, it's not witnesses, it's not pleadings, it's not discovery. I go to court with what's called a writ for, it's called a petition for a writ of certiorari. They're rubber stamped by the clerk. The next instance is the two attorneys agree on the record of the case. And the third and final step is the attorneys brief that case and appear before the judge and make their arguments. And that's what certiorari is. And that's what BOA does when there's an appeal of an HPC decision. So the record is very important. And that might be most of what I have to say.
I've got one real quick question. Again, I would recommend that everybody on the commission review everything here. I think the last time we really talked about it, I mean, we've only had one hearing so far. And it was a pretty easy one, too, yes. And it is a complicated process, and we actually did a practice case one time, and I think we did okay, but not great.
Well, you did okay, but
Andy and one thing I would like to have you comment a little bit on is that what would you recommend the commission do if we do get an application? There's a temptation to go out and look at that site. Yeah, and what exactly is our responsibility to go out and determine something before we actually go for the hearing?
Don't do it. There is a tendency. I'm glad you brought that up, because I made a note to remember to discuss it and forgot that note. A lot of times, when you know something's coming your way, when it's on the next agenda, sometimes various members of various quasi-judicial boards, like you all, do homework. They might actually have talks with other members of the commission. They might go out and view the property. They might do some investigative homework, and heaven forbid, they may even talk to the applicant or the neighbors around the applicant's property. Those things happen, but they shouldn't happen, because it's a violation of the applicant's due process rights. The bottom line, I don't care if it comes from ex parte communications or conflicts of interest or whatever, the crucial bottom line that cannot be wavered from at all is the fact that each one of you has to be impartial at the time the hearing is conducted, so that you base your decision only on the evidence that's presented in that hearing. So in order to safeguard that constitutional right, if anybody does have and has done external homework or had ex parte communications or discussed the case with anybody else, it is their obligation at the start of the hearing to disclose that fact and to disclose what they learned in that by taking that action. So that way the applicant has the benefit of, has two benefits. One, if he thinks that that's resulting in a partial instead of an impartial bias, he can move to have that board commission member recused and excused, or he also gets the applicant also gets the benefit of knowing what the person who took those actions now knows and can therefore modify his approach accordingly. So it's good, but the best policy is don't do it. It just creates all kinds of problems and opens the door if they have the resources. And for example, Sombra, the residential construction that will take place within the pod, was represented by a very good attorney from a very tough firm. But ex parte and exterior homework definitely opens the door to make it a much easier path to seek judicial review and make the argument that the exterior actions and ex parte communications were detrimental to the applicant's case. So don't do it. Just don't do it. Any other questions, particularly from the newcomers?
That would have been the first thing I did.
That's why I wanted to bring it up, yeah. You can't do the homework.
You ready for a quasi-judicial?
Always studying, no.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Read it.
Yeah, you definitely spend some time looking at it. I am certainly going to review it again, even though I've been thinking about it for years. All right, the last agenda item is we have a historic plaque update. It has me as the presenter of this, but this actually goes back, if I believe this is what we're talking about. And, Jim, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about this, the historic plaque that we've kind of tossed around for the last 2 years?
The building inspector and Punky Carey and myself made a survey of the town regarding the barracks that used to be down during World War II at Fort Fisher. And after the war, they were sold off, and a number of them have been moved to town. And we think we compiled a fairly full list of the addresses of those, and we intend on sitting down with the Federal Point Historic Society and see about being able to plaque those houses, or at least make them make the plaque available to the owners.
Okay. And one of the things we've talked about, too, is trying to encourage other folks that have older houses to approach the Federal Point Historic Commission.
Basically, 50 years.
Yeah, it's 50 and 100 years. And aren't those the two categories? If you're over 50 years, you get one type of plaque?
I know the one is over 50. I don't know about the 100.
Okay, all right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, and so the idea is to get historic plaques out there. It doesn't give any rights other than... it's kind of a neat thing for people
bragging
to have.
Rights.
Yeah, bragging rights. So, so with regard to the barracks, you're going through that process right now. Okay, all right, good.
Greg, didn't we say at one point we're going to put out on the website or an email or something, letting people know that they have that opportunity to approach the Federal Point if their house is
right? I think the reason we didn't do it is I think there was a little bit of discussion about, is that the responsibility of the Historic Preservation Commission to do that? Or is that the responsibility of somebody else or some other group?
And that's, the homeowners themselves pay for the plaque.
Right.
So the plaque doesn't come out of town funds or it doesn't come out of the History Center funds.
I just mean as an awareness.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody that has a house that they bought, it was 40 years old, they bought it 10 years ago, now it's 50 years old, may not know that this even exists.
Probably most people don't know.
Yeah.
I believe, how many plaques do we have in Cary Beach? We talked about that before. There are only about five or six, aren't there?
Yeah, if even that.
Yeah.
If you want to know what a plaque looks like, on the pier, house was plaqued a couple of years ago.
Mandy, I'll ask you, I guess, who would be responsible for getting out information about historic plaques? Is that really the role of the HPC or somebody else? I mean, we talk about it in the HPC, but I'm not sure if it's really our role.
I could get together with her and see if I can work something out.
With the Historic Society?
The History
Society. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Maybe in their newsletter. Do they still do the newsletter?
Is there anything the town of Cary Beach sends out to all residences that we might be able to put something in?
The town news.
I mean, it seems to me that would be the the place to put something.
Yeah, put it on the website.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely not an HPC.
No, it's not an HPC. We talk about it, but it's really not an HPC responsibility.
I mean, if you guys want to write something up or you want to come up with something that you want us to send out.
Yeah.
Okay. We can do that.
Yeah, I noticed you're looking at Jim right when you asked that.
I'm addressing
Jim, you want to take the lead on that? Or you
want just to write up something that could be sent out?
You want to take the lead on that as far as?
Sure.
Well, good. With that, is there a motion to adjourn?
No, before we adjourn. Before we adjourn. Are we going to consider going to the iPads for this committee also, or no? We're going to stay paper.
They do not need enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
right.
Good.
All right. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.